This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. As the Republican National Convention opens in Cleveland, Ohio, the presidential election season is looking more like a circus than a serious political exercise. Presumptive nominee Donald Trump has announced Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. And on day one of the convention, a rally in support of Trump is expected to take place in Cleveland, attracting gun-toting right-wing supporters of the businessman-turned-politician. But the issue of guns has begun to invoke fear in all sectors of society in the wake of two major shootings of police officers in Dallas, Texas, and this past weekend in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Three officers were killed and several others injured in a shooting that has left people shocked. An African-American man named Gavin Long was killed by police as a suspected shooter. Like the Dallas shooter, Micah Johnson, Long served in the U.S. military. Authorities are already blaming the Black Lives Matter movement for creating an atmosphere that targets police, but BLM has avowedly denounced the killings. How can the central issue of police violence and the grassroots activism of Black Lives Matter translate into positive change, particularly through democratic and electoral means? Joining me to help answer that question is Rashad Robinson. He's the executive director of Color of Change, the former senior director of programs at GLAAD. He's actually in Cleveland for the RNC. Welcome to the program, Rashad.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about what has been happening over the weekend with these killings. When the Dallas shooting happened, it was very shocking. It's very rare for that many police officers to be killed, at one single time. But then so soon after, Baton Rouge happened. But Baton Rouge, of course, notably was one of the flashpoints of the Black Lives Matter movement in the wake of Alton Sterling's killing that was videotaped just over the past few weeks. How do you make sense of these two incidents?
You know, I think we're in really trying times, a time where, you know, with so much happening in social media and mainstream media, that we oftentimes are not getting all the information we need. We're rushing to judgment. We have, people benefiting from using, grandiose language, not sticking with the facts. And as a result, I think we're moving further and further apart as a country. The killings of Philando and Alton, as well as the attacks and killings of those police officers, should give all Americans pause. They help us, I think, continue to start having the conversations we need to have about guns, about racial inequality, about how do we protect and support our law enforcement. But more than anything, they should be mobilizing us around action on the issues that we need to be dealing with, whether it's ensuring that good police officers are supported the way they should because we're dealing with police accountability in this country, ensuring that we are actually getting guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't be and have real sensible gun policy, that we're dealing with mental health in this country in a sensible and clear way. These are all things that we should be taking away from that, and we're not going to get there if we're constantly just trying to score political points without developing the type of work that we need to do to bring about real action.
Now, Rashad, those who have a preconceived idea of what these shootings mean might say the two suspected shooters were both Black. They both had strong feelings about police violence. However, there's a very obvious other commonality as well, which is that they both had military experience. And I'm wondering if these shootings should also be seen as an outcome of our foreign policy and the PTSD of soldiers intersecting with, racialized police violence.
You know, as I talk to members of my own family who have served overseas, the impact of serving in war, the things that folks see is real. I also don't want to jump to rush to judgment around sort of mental health. But what I do know is that we do not invest enough in mental health in this country across the board, from supporting our vets when they come home to screening potential law enforcement around mental health. There's a lot we've got to do to ensure that, we are giving people the tools they need to live healthy, you know, lives in our society.
Let's talk about the fact that the Black Lives Matter movement is being blamed. I mean, even when politicians don't come out and clearly identify Black Lives Matter, they kind of imply that there's just too much criticism of police officers, that the tone of the rhetoric has to be turned all the way down, zero tolerance, et cetera, et cetera. All of these implying that violence against police officers is the fault of those people who are speaking up about police violence. Whereas before Black Lives Matter, the issue of police violence wasn't on anyone's radar. Politicians didn't care about police killing, disproportionately killing Black Americans.
This is the classic pushback that we're going to see from politicians who would rather these problems go away than actually have to take clear steps to solve it. Because in order to solve them, it's going to lead them into tough waters. So last week, I was actually at the White House meeting with President Obama.
That's right.
Members of law enforcement, you know, elected officials, the governor of Louisiana, as well as the head of the state police department in Louisiana. They were both at that meeting, along with many other folks from you know, society, you know, civil rights, elected officials, members of the president's cabinet. And there were about 33 of us. We met for about 4 hours. You know, I spoke directly about really clear actions that we were demanding the president take, from how the federal government should be using the lever of its executive power to pull back money from local departments that don't ensure that Black lives are protected, that we have to re-incentivize or change the incentive structure for police departments to do the right thing. The Baton Rouge Police Department has actually gotten upwards of $3 million from the federal government over the last 5 years, even while being under a Department of Justice oversight for civil rights. I'm here in Cleveland and I'm seeing lots of military and riot gear. But what a lot of folks don't know is that the federal government actually gave $50 million to the Cleveland police just recently for this equipment. This equipment that the Cleveland Police Department is actually going to get to keep after the RNC convention's over.
Wow.
The Cleveland Police Department is actually under consent decree from the Department of Justice for violation of civil rights. So this is a department that has been labeled with consent decree, has had to form a consent decree with the Department of Justice to change their practices, has now just gotten $50 million of militarized equipment. We have to change the incentive structure. And unfortunately, politicians want to actually talk about something else. They want to talk about what activists should or shouldn't be saying. But that's not their job. Their job is to figure out public policy and laws that will actually change the way people live. So right now we need action from our politicians. We need them to actually place accountability in place. And spending time worrying about the words and the protest of activists without actually hearing their demands and trying to respond to them is not what we need right now.
Now, President Obama's town hall last Thursday that was televised by ABC and meant to address these heightening tensions between police and community was criticized by many people, among them Erica Garner, Eric Garner's daughter, who basically said that ABC cut her out of the broadcast after promising she could ask a question. But Obama was sitting there basically trying to address these issues both in front of people who have been personally impacted by police violence and police officers themselves. Patrice Cullors, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, has criticized the police, saying, criticized President Obama, saying that he says that Black Lives Matter, but he doesn't actually ensure that they do. She wrote a Guardian article to that effect. How do you met President Obama? What could he have done? Couldn't he have done a little bit better in the town hall?
Sure. And I think town halls are fine. I'm actually not that interested in town halls. I think it's important. While I think it's important to come together and have dialogue, right now we need action.
Right.
We need public policy. We need a change in incentive structures for how local law departments see their job. Patrice is a really great friend. I actually talked to her right before the ABC town hall and right after. And I know that she was really hoping to bring some of the same concerns that I've brought to you, some of the same conversations around the funding structures from the federal government to the local government. You know, we're running a campaign specifically on this. Folks can visit us at colorofchange.org to sign that petition. And Color of Change and Black Lives Matter and other have been working in close collaboration to try to build the type of energy that pushes, you know, the president and others to do more. The president, you know, has a bully pulpit, has a public profile. He has to bring people together. I wish the town hall would have been different. The private meeting, though, that we had, I felt like the president with 33 people really spent time listening and having a back and forth discussion. I even had a moment where I had a bit of an exchange with the head of Fraternal Order of Police, an association of or an organization that, you know, over and over again refuses to put any type of public policy on the table, simply just kind of knee-jerk says that police are not the problem, never, you know, calls on police officers to be fired. So we had a little bit of a back and forth publicly at that meeting. But I think the president brought together a diverse audience for the private meeting. It's unfortunate that once you brought in sort of corporate media and some other folks, that the meeting wasn't as productive.
Now, on the one hand, the president really is expected to use his bully pulpit. On the other hand, being the nation's first Black president, he is seen, particularly by non-Black Americans, as being, you know, unforgivably biased towards African Americans, even if he hasn't actually taken enough concrete steps to improve the Black communities, you know, the very many indicators, social indicators that plague the community. He showed up at the Dallas Police Officers Memorial. You know, when has the president ever showed up to the memorial of victims of police violence? And the numbers, however, don't lie. The numbers show that Black Americans are far more likely to be killed by police than police are to be killed by Black Americans, or any Americans for that matter. If President Obama really was to address the issue, then he would, you know, certainly please a lot of Black Lives Matter activists. He would anger almost everybody else.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky situation. I also think it's a tricky situation legally. Lots of the places where, you know, there's been a killing of an unarmed Black person, my organization, other organizations have called for Department of Justice investigations or the Department of Justice to engage. And once the Department of Justice starts to engage and has an investigation, the president showing up at one of those places could create the type of problems or challenges that wouldn't be helpful for the investigation, much the way you saw the sort of hubbub when President Clinton and Loretta Lynch met on that tarmac.
Right.
So there is a bit of a challenge here if the Department of Justice is truly going to investigate. It's not always clear whether the Department of Justice is actually investigating in these situations. And I would like to see the president spend more time in certain communities. But it's been hard to get the sort of visuals that I think the community needs to feel like the president is going deep on these issues with us.
And it's also
that said, right. Visuals are just part of the problem. I mean, or just part of the issue. I think what we really need, once again, I will say, is action on behalf of the president and his administration.
And just going back to these incidents when there have been these two police shootings, and in so many other incidents, really, police managed to shoot their suspected perpetrator far more often when the suspected perpetrator is African-American. And then we're left trying to figure out Micah Johnson's motives, Gavin Long's motive. However, of course, the young white man who killed so many African-Americans at a church in North Carolina last year, you know, and so many other white mass shooters, we manage and police manage to arrest them alive. And it just kind of blows me away that these other shooters of color are killed on the spot, and we never really get to go through a trial, never get to understand what their motives might have been, who really motivated them. And then we do these posthumous dissections of their social media accounts.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really challenging that we continue to see different types of justice. And I definitely agree with what you just said. And when police officers, you know, kill an unarmed Black person, like you know, Alton Sterling, or in other situations that we've seen, they benefit from a different justice system than the rest of us. You know, police officers can get anywhere, depending on the state they're in, get anywhere upwards of 30 to 45 days before they're even questioned.
Right.
They're allowed to see sort of body camera or other footage before they're having to be interrogated about the situation. They're offered sort of, oftentimes the first call that they make is to their union rep rather than the ambulance after they kill someone. And so how do we fix this situation is going to take many different parts. And you spoke to sort of the cultural and the humanity issue, the fact that oftentimes we're seeing folks with different through a different lens. We're seeing some people with more humanity and giving them the more benefit of the doubt. And then we also have a situation that even once the killing has happened, the justice system doesn't just have sort of different rules at the cultural level. It actually has different rules at the written and structural level.
Now, the let's talk about the RNC, the Republican National Convention, where you are at. You're in Cleveland. This is going to be a very interesting several days. First of all, I'm kind of impressed that you're in Cleveland. I was kind of scared to be in Cleveland. Ohio is an open carry state, even though the Secret Service has, you know, decided that no weapons are allowed within the convention hall itself, the perimeter around the convention hall, where a lot of activism is going to be taking place from both the right and the left. The city has been unable to ban guns, ban weapons. They have tried to ban and succeeded in banning all other weapons besides guns, even fake guns, but just not real guns, which is just kind of shows or indicates the ridiculousness of it. Rashad, there have been Trump supporters showing up armed in public and basically exercising their, quote, Second Amendment rights as they show up for the NRA supporting Trump at the convention. However, just imagine if a bunch of licensed Black activists, you know, who had license to carry guns, showed up to criticize Trump or criticize somebody else or to, you know, support Black Lives Matter. Can you just imagine the completely different standards by which these two groups would be measured simply because of their politics and the color of their skin?
Well, that's America, and that's what's happening. And I've been out here in Cleveland and seen seen the guns. I've seen, you know, the protest, you know, and I've also sort of seen the power of lobby, the power of the NRA, the power that the NRA has over this state, where the laws couldn't be changed and can't be changed around open carry. I hope that this conversation around open carry, as we head into this convention, what the conversations we've had in Minnesota and Louisiana these last couple of weeks around open carry in Texas as well, start pushing us into a new understanding of how outrageous our gun laws are and what we've got to do to fix that.
Right. Essentially, open carry is just for white people. The Second Amendment is just for white people. Philando Castile, who had a license for the gun that he was carrying, was shot because he mentioned he had a gun and that he was licensed to carry it. And the officer panicked. And now Mr. Castile is dead. And had that man been white, had Philando been white, it's very likely that he would not have been killed, that he would still be alive today. Well, finally, Rashad, I want to ask you about how this whole energy around Black Lives Matter, the criticism of police violence, the act, the grassroots, and, you know, all peaceful protest against police violence can be translated into action. You know, it's not just a matter of who's on the presidential ticket. There are many sort of down ballot issues. And I know that your organization, Color of Change, was one of those instrumental in, for example, preventing the re-election of Anita Alvarez in Chicago, the district attorney there, over her refusal to prosecute the officer who killed Laquan McDonald. How, first of all, tell us how important that action was and how it can be replicated around the country to have Black Lives Matter activism translated into real action because, you know, in the absence of politicians taking action.
Absolutely. You know, the Anita Alvarez situation has been big for us because we were engaged in pushing back against Anita Alvarez for years. You know, 4 years ago, we ran some campaigns on Anita Alvarez because she refused to release six young Black men who were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to anywhere between 15 to 25 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. DNA evidence had exonerated them. The Innocence Project was involved. And because the police officers who were originally involved with the case and planting the evidence had moved up through the ranks, Anita Alvarez just sat on it while the DNA evidence sat there exonerating. We ran campaigns against Anita Alvarez for it and got those men released, but shouldn't have had to go through all the work we did to get her to actually do her job. Fast forward, we continue our dealing with Anita Alvarez, but recognize the opportunity to really pull the lever electorally. And not only were we lucky in being able to have a larger coalition of organizations on the ground and national groups that were able to come together, we actually had a candidate in Kim Fox that we wanted to support, who was actually going to make a commitment to thinking differently about criminal justice and really being a champion for criminal justice reform. We'll still see how all that pans out, but we had a candidate that was willing to speak to the movement. We've been working now all around the country to sort of figure out the next set of district attorney races we want to get involved with. And there's a lot of opportunities. 70% of district attorneys in this country run unopposed. 80% of those that run unopposed are white men. We've got a lot of work to start changing the incentive structures. So DAs know that someone will run against them if they're not doing their job, that we're going to mobilize and engage our movement around these efforts. And we're also going to start building the right candidate pipelines. So we start getting folks who want to do the right thing, who want to look at criminal justice reform differently in these offices and who want to run for these offices. So we're doing a lot of work around district attorneys. We've got some seats that we're going to be engaged in Ohio and Florida and Texas. And think that this is going to be a really important way to make people's political participation real. You know, so often we tell people to concentrate on the top of the ticket, but the most powerful actors in the criminal justice space are local DAs, and they control so much about what happens for everyday people, and particularly Black folks in their relationships with the criminal justice system because the disproportionate engagement. And so we want to make sure that those elected officials are seeing that people are mobilizing and paying attention, and that we'll vote good people in and we'll vote bad people out. And we'll start, hopefully, as a result, raising the floor on what's acceptable from district attorneys and start moving the ceiling up in terms of what's possible and how we can imagine a justice system that works for all of us.
Give out the website again for Color of Change, Rashad.
Go to colorofchange.org. Visit us at colorofchange.org. You can visit us on Twitter or Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter as well at Rashad Robinson. Stay engaged with us in this effort, and there'll be more both on our electoral work and our work specifically around criminal justice.
That's colorofchange.org. Rashad, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thanks for having
me. Stay safe out there in Cleveland, please.
I will.
Rashad Robinson is the executive director of Color of Change, one of the nation's most important civil rights organizations. He's also a former senior director of programs at GLAAD. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.